She's up and present your bill, and I guess we need to move.
Madam Chair?
Let's file.
We're all eager to move this bill.
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 196 and for passage and re-referral to Finance.
Public Safety.
Finance.
Doesn't it have to go back up to Finance?
Public Safety Finance via Finance.
Okay, so to Finance with recommendation to re-refer to Public Safety Finance.
Very good. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the enthusiastic movers of the bill as well. And House Bill 196, the section we're going to be looking at today in this committee is on page 25 of the bill, Article 3, Section 5, Section... wait a minute, that's not right. It's Article 3, but it's Section 15 and Subdivision 4. And this is the Bridges Rental Housing Program. And certainly for people with mental illness, when they are in the usual revolving door, they have a great need for stable housing. I think housing and employment are the two biggest parts of substantial and sustainable recovery that there is for people with serious and persistent mental illness. And often, as this committee knows, regular housing is not available. So the Bridges housing that I know Madam Chair and others on this committee are very familiar with helps to bridge that gap, and hence the name. And I have with me Sue Afterholden, the director of NAMI Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sue Abdeholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. And, you know, the President's New Freedom Commission said that what people really need is a job and a home and a date on a Saturday night. And so this provides the home piece. And I think we all know that in order to recover from a serious mental illness, you really do need stable housing. Right now, if you're on Supplemental Security Income, SSI, there is not one housing market in the state of Minnesota that you can afford on what you get. The Section 8 waiting lists are longer than ever, and so people really need the Bridges Housing Program while they wait for the Section 8 program to open up so that only 30% of their income then goes to housing instead of closer to 90% or 100%. This bill would actually increase the program to serve over 300 new people, and so we think it's really sorely needed. And I thank you.
Any further witnesses or discussion?
No, I'm sure unless there's anyone in the audience, but we knew we needed to take a chart, so we did.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the phone? Not any questions from committee members?
Madam Chair and Representative Grinning, the suicide prevention grant is also under this jurisdiction, or is it not?
Representative Grinning, we just noticed that it is on page
51. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McFarland. I didn't realize that one was under here, so Afterholden has advised me you have heard that already as a separate bill, but if that's in this committee, we hope you'll fund that as well.
Grinning, can you give us a number there? Do you know what the number
it is? Number, finance.
The blank line right now.
Is that in each year or just one year? $2.2 million, Madam Chair, for the biennium. I've just been advised by from the Mental Health Association.
So $1.1 in each?
Yep.
Look. Any other questions? If not, Representative Morgan, with a little music in the background, renews his motion that House File 196 be recommended to pass and be referred on to the Finance Committee for future Finance Committees. Okay. All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You are on your way, Representative Grinning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schumper. Representative Dominguez. You know that people are back and forth in various committees, and so... Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dominguez. And you, House File 291 for us. President Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move House File 1047.
Oh, it's 291.
Oh, excuse me. 297, yes.
291.
Excuse me. 291. It has a 7 here. That's the last time you're calling on me for anything, I'm sure.
No, this is fine.
291, I'm out to get Dominguez here.
And where would this bill go, Representative Dominguez, after?
I believe it's recommended to go to Finance.
This is not laid over for inclusion in our bill? Seems like it might be. Let's see if we can clarify that while we're here.
Okay.
So go ahead, Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a bill that's relating to Veterans Home. This one here authorized certain commissary privileges, and it's amending statute section 198.075. I know that you're short on time, so I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers here, and I hope that you consider this bill. It's been already through several committees. And so we'd like to get a final passage on this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to my left here is Chip Cox. And also to his left is Mark McGee from ASME Council 5. So Chip Cox will go first.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself to the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Charles Chip Cox. I'm the interim executive director of the Veterans Homes Board. The Veterans Homes Board is responsible for the operation of 5 veterans homes in the state of Minnesota. The veterans homes are home to over 800 veterans, and there's about 1,000 employees employed at the veterans homes in the 5 homes. This bill will take care of situations that arise when we need staff to work additional hours, overtime hours. Quite often those staff come to work. They find out they will be working an overtime shift, usually in the last hour of work, and have not made provisions to bring an extra amount of food with them for the dinner meal or the lunch meal or whatever the case may be. So we're asking that we can provide those staff a complimentary meal on the day of the overtime for them to take part in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee with ASME Council 5. Current law, as Mr. Cox stated, prohibits these sort of commissary privileges. And the language we add here makes it permissive. I think it was in a subcommittee, we changed the shall to a may, which means that if this passes, it would be permissive for management to provide such benefit at their discretion. It would also open the possibility that this could be negotiated in a future contract with state employees. In addition to AFSCME, Council 5, I know the Minnesota Nurses Association has supported this legislation. Thank you.
Any questions from committee members? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question for either the testifiers or the author, I'm surprised that... See, do you not have the ability, Mr. Cox, with the labor unions to negotiate this on your own and just reach a mutual agreement? Do we actually have to legislatively do this, or could you do this on your own?
Mr. Cox.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, up until this point, we could not because it prohibited us from doing that. Is
said that no employee of the veteran's home could have any privileges, including food, laundry, and et cetera.
Mr. McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Cox, would it be your intention then, if this legislation passed, to offer this for these folks?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that would be our intention.
Any further questions? Okay, Danielle.
Depends on what home you're at, Madam Chair.
All right, let me see what we're offering here. Okay, if there's no further discussion, anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay, if not, the motion, Representative Benson's motion is before us at House File 291. You recommended to pass, and my understanding is it can either go to floor, or if you want, it can be included in our omnibus bill here. So, Representative Dominguez, it's your call.
What is the search as far as what's the best way to go,
Madam Chair?
Mr. McNamara?
I make a suggestion, Representative Dominguez. This should get done for sure. So if you do it both ways, I would suggest this is. I mean, these folks were trying to. Mr. Cox is trying to do a deal. The union is trying to do a deal. We got to get some of this stuff done. Let these folks be getting to taking care of our veterans. And so I guess I would like it, if, Madam Chair, if you'd find it to put it in your omnibus bill. And Representative Dominguez, I don't know. I guess I would defer to the chair, Madam. But what about we put it on the consent calendar? Do you think it...
McNamara, I think that may be a very good idea.
I mean, I guess I would have to check with my fearless leader that he doesn't put it in the category of the two meals on weekend prison situation. But, Madam Chair, we better not, now that I think about it, we better not put it on the consent calendar. But I certainly will speak for it that we get it done.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this fits in our omnibus bill. I think that's the proper place for it. I would make that, I'd make that suggestion or even that motion that we included in our omnibus bill.
Representative Krentz, and are you saying to do that instead of or in addition?
Chair, I think this should be in our omnibus bill, and so that's where I'm recommending it. I would not like to see this be on the floor. So I would like to see this in our omnibus bill.
Madam Chair?
Is that McNamara?
Well, the only reason, Representative Krantz, I would recommend we do put it in an omnibus bill, too, but I also would recommend that we move it separate. I mean, one, this would be great legislation to move right away and get done, if possible. And I don't know, Madam Chair, I would hope that it wouldn't get hung up at some point anyway that we could do it. So I'm whatever you decide, I just, it's one of those that might make sense to move a couple ways.
Representative Dominguez?
Madam Chair, I think we can, as Representative McNamara said, that we'll do both. I think this is a bipartisan bill. I think this is something that we need to take care of our veterans and our staff that work at the veterans' home. Looking at it, you're correct. This is something that really needs to get done quick as possible, and they're looking forward to doing it. That's why I brought this bill forward. So,
make one comment to that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. I think we need to work on limiting the amount of overtime that these folks are actually doing.
That would be correct.
And so my concern is that this may, having a background in labor, may be an interesting situation where we may have more. I'm not saying that that's the intent of the testifiers here, but I'm concerned that if we have some benefits, there might be more of a willingness on behalf of administration to increase the number of overtime hours. Now, does that mean that they certainly don't deserve a free meal? I'm not going to take up that debate right now, but I think we need to be cautious, and I'm just going to make my statement here that, you know, I think we need to go carefully. I mean, nobody's going to argue that we shouldn't be taking care of veterans and that our workers in this area don't work their butts off for very, you know, minimal wages and tons of hours. So do the Nurses Association. I know exactly why they support this, but I'm saying if we go down this road, I'd like to also have a commitment on the other side where we're saying we're going to actually limit the number of overtime hours that these people are already working. So I guess that's my statement.
Thank you for the comment, Representative Krantz. Madam Chair, is your wishes?
Let me just ask a question here, Ms. Devin. I think the effective date is not spelled out on this. So the effective date would be the can help us.
June 30th?
It's not a money bill, so the effective date would be June 30th.
Okay, so we're not necessarily picking up any time by sending it to the floor earlier. So in that case, what is that, Mayor?
Madam Chair, I'd like to make an amendment that we make the effective date the day after enactment.
Okay, is that your...
I just want to see this bill move, and I defer with Representative Kranz. I'm not going to make it into a floor fight, but I just would like to see it. I just think it's the kind of positive step we need to make forward. These folks have been here to testify, and I just think if this gives the management a tool, we should do it. And somebody's going to argue about it. I mean, if I understand correctly, they've almost eliminated the mandatory overtime. It's almost entirely voluntary. I don't even, Mr. Cox could speak to that, but I think that's that situation's been taken care of. So I guess if you don't want to, I'm okay with just putting it in the omnibus if that's what you want to do.
Let me just do a little clarification. Mr. Cox, is this accurate that mandatory overtime has been eliminated at the... I had not heard that.
Madam Chair, not all mandatory overtime has been eliminated. There are certain circumstances where it's necessary. But we have seen an up in... increase of people voluntarily picking up additional shifts, and that helps us go a long ways from mandating. Occasionally, you have to mandate. I mean, we try to keep it as little as possible. It's not good morale to be mandating people on a regular basis. But I do, as I said before, we do have a number of people that are starting to pick up additional shifts for the additional income. So it's minimal. Mandating has become a very minimal tool. But occasionally, yes, we do need to mandate when that circumstance comes up and it's, you know, we need someone to be at the next shift. And we try to keep, if they are mandated, we try to make it for as little as time as possible. Maybe 4 hours, maybe 2 hours, until we call somebody else in to come to work. We don't want people working 16-hour shifts. Especially when they're mandated.
President Dominguez?
Madam Chair, I'm reconsidering. We'd be happy to put it in Osmus bill and carry forward. I've worked on a bipartisan effort on this issue with Representative Severson. He can tell you that. And we included some things in this bill together. And I think it's a good bill, as you heard today. So we're fine with that.
President McNamara, I don't know if you actually made a motion or not.
No, I can withdraw my motion.
All right. The bill is before us, and the motion is to pass it and take it into the omnibus bill. So, any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I think are we just laying it over for possible inclusion, actually?
Correct. It's going to be laid over for inclusion. That's the motion that we did in the omnibus bill. Is there any further discussion on that? Okay, if not, then this is laid over for the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, so the next bill would be Ben Morgan.
I might find a way to put in an amendment.
Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1851 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Present your bill.
Before I present the bill, I do have a small oral amendment that I would like to move on line 1.8. Delete added 2 delete the words added to. And after budget, add for the Housing Trust Fund.
So that would Morgan be, moves that an oral amendment that after the word budget we add for the Housing Trust Fund, puts it in the form that he would like to have it considered. Any discussion?
Could you repeat that again?
Sure.
Madam Chair, I'll repeat as it should
read. That's
all right. So it would read, the last sentence on line 1.8 would read, this appropriation is the agency's base budget for the Housing Trust Fund.
I see. So the motion is to delete is added to and after budget to insert for the Housing Trust Fund. Any discussion on the amendments? Not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The amendment is adopted and the bill as amended is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today I'm presenting House File 1851. The bill will appropriate $15 million in general funds above the governor's proposed budget for the 2008-2009 biennium to the commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for the Housing Trust Fund account. The Housing Trust Fund will provide capital, operating, and rental subsidy to new supportive housing projects funded by the state. We're going to try and keep our testimony here to 5 minutes. I have two presenters to support the bill. To my far left, George Stone, and next to me, Phillips. I'm sorry. And they will speak on behalf of the bill. Thank you.
Good evening. Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing. I do have handouts if I could have those passed out. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm the Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing, board member of the Minnesota and the National Coalition for the Homeless, as well as of MICA, the Metro Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. I was very actively involved in the development of the Housing Trust Fund when it was passed in 1988 with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and the Minnesota Housing Partnership. Initially, while the Minnesota Realtors Association opposed the bill, we did convince them that it was a good bill to get on, and they did support that bill in the passage in 1988. In 2001, in the legislative session, we made a change in the Housing Trust Fund that allowed for the use of the dollars for operations of housing programs as well as tenant subsidies or rent subsidies, both tenant-based, which would be scattered site with people in their own units, and project-based sites where it'd be one particular place that may be owned by a nonprofit. Elam Transitional Housing was the first to use the Housing Trust Fund as a rent subsidy program and was the first to also contracted to use the Housing Trust Fund for long-term homeless rent subsidies. In 2005, we served, and if you look in the information that you have in front of you in our annual report, if you look on the bottom on the inside right-hand side, you will see on the two lower programs that are identified there, the Housing Trust Fund for the Rent Subsidy Program, which includes folks that are not long-term homeless, and then also the Long-Term Homeless Rent Subsidy Program. Both of those programs are scattered site, which means we utilize rental property by primarily private landlords in the community throughout the metro area and a little bit outside of the metro area. Our primary focus is Anoka and Hennepin County. During 2005, we served 139 families, 174 adults in those families, 223 children, with an average income of less than $7,800 per year. Moving them out of the shelter system into housing. I think one of the key things to remember about the Housing Trust Fund rent subsidy portion of the program, both for long-term homeless as well as the regular rent subsidy program, is that it saves us an incredible amount of money. About 90 to 95% of the folks that we move into the subsidy program come straight out of the shelter system. Now, for 1 year of housing assistance, that'll cost us about $5,000. To have a family in a Hennepin County shelter for 1 month costs $5,000 to $8,000 a month. So for 1 month's shelter costs, we can house a family for an entire year through this program. It's a very successful program. It's been, as you look in that packet, you will see that we've been written up significantly nationally and studied nationally in Hennepin County with our Rapid Exit Program. The Housing Trust Fund rent subsidies is a key component to moving families and individuals rapidly out of the shelter system into housing, into the community, stabilizing them, helping them get jobs, going to school, and having their children go to school. So I strongly encourage you to support the significant increase that we're talking about above the governor's budget. Obviously, we think that it's an important piece of funding. As I testified last week, the Housing Solutions Act would put it at $25 million per year. Obviously, we'd like to see that amount of money available in the Housing Trust Fund to assist families, individuals, and youth. But obviously, we are very supportive of House File 1851 and encourage you to support that as base funding.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. First of all, good evening, and thank you for allowing me to come and speak in support of House File 1851. I will keep my comments short in the interest of time and because most of the information is actually in a packet which I provided for each of the members.
Introduce yourself at the tape, please.
I'm so sorry. Yes, my name is George Stone, and I'm the director of the Corporation for Supportive Housing Minnesota Program. So I will keep my comments brief. To start, to keep pace with the state's plan to end long-term homelessness and to continue to support the other critical affordable housing needs in our state, an investment of $37 million in the Housing Trust Fund is needed. The governor's proposed $22 million, and I might say that that was actually fairly well received by the affordable housing community as a good start. We're coming to the legislature to ask you to add an additional $15 million to that request for the next biennium, which will help us be able to provide additional capital operating and rental subsidy to new supportive housing as well as general affordable housing projects funded throughout the state. The state's plan, as I referenced, calls for the creation of 4,000 household or units of, or as they refer to it, housing opportunities for persons experiencing long-term homelessness. Virtually all the households will need some level of operating subsidy or rental assistance, whether it's project-based or tenant-based, as Sue mentioned. The state's made significant progress in meeting these goals throughout 2006. There's been much work done. As a matter of fact, at the end of 2006, nearly 1,100 supportive housing opportunities had been financed. However, this year, separate bills are being heard by the legislature to increase funding to the Department of Human Services for supportive housing or supportive services tied to the long-term homeless. And without the necessary rental assistance provided through the Housing Trust Fund, our communities will be unable to access the vital subsidies that enable them to target the units to an extremely low-income, high-risk population. In your package, you will find letters of support from various organizations like Sue Watla Phillips' organization who utilize the Housing Trust Fund program in order to operate and to serve the needs of people experiencing long-term homelessness. I call the attention to the fact that these programs are serving folks throughout the state, including the Northeast, the Southeast, St. Cloud, and the metro area. And so I am here to ask for your support in supporting House File 1851 and to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Any questions for either of the witnesses or the author? One question. Can you remind me again of how many families or individuals you might be serving if we were able to give this full appropriation? And if not, you know, per, if we needed to cut it back, and I may involve where what this committee's target is. And so, obviously, we can't do the whole thing. I'm just wondering if you can tell us per the current proposal that you have.
Madam Chair, Sue Walker Phillips. It varies a little bit from program to program, but looking very quickly at the number of family units that are being served, we're looking at probably around 5,000 to 6,000 per year per family unit. And again, that could include singles or youth as a family unit, or people without children, as well as families that may be single or two-parent families.
And that's with the full appropriation?
That's the average right now on an annual basis per family unit.
Okay, that's average cost per family unit. Okay.
And I would just like to add, this is George Stone again, that it does vary, and it also varies depending on the use of the Housing Trust Fund. In the packet, you'll see that one of the organizations primarily uses it for rental assistance, which is how much of this funding would be perceived as being used. However, one of the organizations also uses it for operating subsidy for their project and also had received Housing Trust Fund for capital. So it's a flexible program, and depending on how that's used, certainly has an impact on how many families or individuals eventually get served.
More questions from the committee members? Thank you. I want to thank you for also all your good work that you do with this program. I appreciate it. And it's probably accurate to say we serve some of the lowest income people. Well, is that correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Morgan, do you have another bill? No, I guess you don't. Nope. Okay, Representative Shepard. Ready with your bill?
Madam Chair, did we play that over for inclusion? Is that what we did?
We laid it over for inclusion. Thank you very much for relaying it. The motion is, and that we laid it over for inclusion. Thank you. Representative Shepard. House File 1047. Welcome back to your committee. And
thank you, Madam Chair. Well,
Mr. Bell?
This is House File 1047. We've taken the most exciting part of this bill out, which had to do with teeth floating.
And, my goodness.
This is a board bill I'm carrying for the Board of Veterinary Medicine, and I have with me Dr. John King, who's the executive director of the board. And I think it'd be best just to have him go.
Okay, well, I'd like you to move your bill and tell us where you want it to go.
To be honest, I'm not quite sure where we need to go with this. It's a licensure bill.
I'm sure.
Okay.
Has this been to A?
Yeah.
Yeah,
September?
That's where
we started. Yes. Started in A. So this is maybe your last stop. Well, let's go forward with the bill, and we'll talk about that.
So
I should describe the bill, maybe become clear.
Why don't I, if it's all right, Madam Chair, I'd like to have
an amendment. I believe. Do you have an amendment that's already been on it, or do you need to amend it now?
Amendment to delete it.
It's on here. Okay. All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Dr. John King. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine. House File 1047 provides for several changes to the Veterinary Practice Act. They're listed there, I believe, on the fact sheet that was distributed with the committee packets. First one is to accept an alternative or a second program for evaluation of the equivalency of the education of foreign veterinary graduates. It's accepted now in 20 states, 2 U.S. territories, and another state it's accepted in with provisions and caveats. The second one is the ability of Board of Veterinary Medicine to collect fees for verification of licensure. When a Minnesota licensed veterinarian applies for licensure in other states, a license verification needs to be sent to that state. That requires staff time and just mailing and taking care of that. That's charging for those fees are consistent within the health licensing boards in Minnesota and across the United States. Also, it allows for the board to collect fee from continuing ed sponsors that are not pre-approved to request CE approval, continuing ed approval for veterinarians, and that also takes board time to research and check the credentials on the speakers. That also is consistent within the other health licensing boards in Minnesota and across the nation. The one regarding the faculty at the University of Minnesota Veterinary Medical Center was requested by the University of Minnesota. They want to, right now it provides for accepting U.S. board certified individuals, and this would allow for European board certified individuals to apply for specialty faculty licensure. Also provides for temporary clinicians to have oversight, direct supervision by a licensed veterinarian when they're practicing. Also, it would eliminate the requirement for the board to have orders served by certified mail. It would provide for direct service or just regular U.S. mail, first class mail. It would also modify and clarify the veterinary dispensing drugs that would be so they would be consistent with the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy language and FDA language. And I'm happy to entertain any questions the committee may have.
Madam Chair, sir, I didn't get your name.
John King.
John King. Mr. King, the program for the assessment of veterinary education equivalents, is this going to be available at the University of Minnesota then, or at all veterinary colleges there in the state of Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative King. Anderson, the program for assessment of veterinary education is for the evaluation of the competency and equivalency of veterinarians that are trained offshore or not in the United States, not by a board or not by an approved and accredited veterinary school. It's an assessment of the education of veterinarians that are trained not in at an approved veterinary school.
So, Madam Chair,
is that Anderson?
Dr. King, this here is this being? It's a has it the backing of any recognized educational facility here in the state, or is it just the veterinarians themselves?
Ms. King,
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, it is supported by the State Veterinary Association and. Right now, the University of Minnesota Veterinary School accepts foreign trained graduates to finish their fourth year of veterinary school at the University of Minnesota, and this would provide for those individuals to expedite their licensure and be able to practice in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Eastman.
Madam Chair, I guess... what's the portion of the bill here that concerns this committee? Is there a specific part of it that we are kind of looking at?
For me, I'm sorry.
What's the portion of the bill that focuses directly on this committee?
Finance.
We have the budget.
Finance. What is the finance committee?
For the veterinarians?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, the Veterinary Medicine Board is... one of the accounts listed in our committee.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. I have one other question.
Is that Eastland?
I was just reading through it, and it's just, you know, maybe it's assumed in here, but looking on page 7, there's some changes that are made there. It talks about a veterinarian or a veterinarian's authorized employee may dispense veterinary prescription drugs, human drugs for extra-label use, or an over-the-counter drug for extra-label use. So we have veterinarians, employees, that are now able to dispense human drugs for extra-label use. And then it talks about the veterinarian, the prescribing veterinarian must monitor the use of veterinarian prescription drugs. How do you monitor the use? We're including human drugs in here for extra label use. It just seems like we're kind of really broadening the scope of what they're going to have the jurisdiction to be able to prescribe. And I guess that's my question is, maybe you could explain what the language here does, or what the intention of the language is.
Madam Chair,
okay.
Representative Eastland. The veterinarians have always had the prescribing authority to prescribe drugs as well. Veterinary prescription drugs and human drugs for extra label use. And their employees have always been authorized to dispense them. That does not mean prescribe them. It means dispense them. And changing this language is going to be consistent with the Board of Pharmacy language when they talk about veterinarians, where human drugs for extra label use is used primarily in veterinary medicine is for companion animals, non-food producing animals, primarily dogs and cats. And that's where that has been used in the past. It doesn't say so because veterinarians are licensed as veterinarians, not as one specific discipline of a veterinarian. And keep having the language in there, the veterinarian is responsible for monitoring the use of the drugs. It's not to key on the human use or the human drugs, but also the extra label use and the veterinary prescription drugs. That goes to speak to the responsibility of the prescribing practitioner and taking responsibility to prevent entrance of contaminated food into the food chain.
Okay. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. King. I guess maybe you could just enlighten me. What is extra human? Extra? What is it? Extra label human. Extra label use. Can you define that for me,
Madam Chair?
Patrick King.
Representative Severson. There's three kinds of drugs that are prescription drugs in veterinary medicine. One are the regular veterinary prescription drugs. Then there's over-the-counter drugs for extra-label use. That means prescribing that, an over-the-counter drug at a dosage higher than it's labeled for by the UFDA in a different route or treating a different disease. So say penicillin is labeled for a cc and a half per 100 pounds, but and it's only labeled for foot rot. Well, the veterinarian prescribes the animal owner to do it at 3 cc's per 100 pounds and treating for mastitis in cows. That's provided. And then extra label use of human drugs would be similar in fashion because it's not a veterinary prescription or legend drug. Veterinarians have always had the ability to prescribe human drugs for extra label use because they're labeled for humans, not animals. Does that answer your question, or is it further confusing?
Madam Chair, Dr. King, so extra label use is basically goes above the normal prescribed amount. Is that what we're saying,
Madam Chair? Extra label use addresses two different things. That's changing or prescribing an over-the-counter drug for a use other than it's prescribed, whether route or prescribing of a human drug for use in animals.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. King, the last line says the veterinarian has met the criteria established in the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 21, Part 530. Where do you fit into the hierarchy of, as far as, are you under federal agricultural, or are you, because you're bringing in human label, extra human label here for human use, do you also fit under the health aspect of, are you cross between the health department and the ag department? Is there kind of a crossover between your profession?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the Board of Veterinary Medicine is akin to the Board of Human Medicine. We license veterinarians and we oversee and regulate their practice. Where it addresses the federal rule, that is the federal, it's called AMDUCA, which is the Animal Medical Drug Use. It addresses specifically what drugs can and cannot be used in food-producing animals. So that's what addresses or prevents the ability of a licensed veterinarian for prescribing human drugs for extra-label use in food-producing animals. So we fit kind of veterinarians are regulated by the Board of Veterinary Medicine primarily, but also the Board of Pharmacy has language that addresses the prescribing authority and provider dispensing authority of veterinarians. And also the veterinarians have to meet the laws regarding what drugs can be used in what species, particularly to protect the food chain, food supply.
Madam Chair, on that note, I would say that maybe, I don't know if Representative Kisa, his committee would want to see this bill or not.
Representative says, I don't think so. Good try, though.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
This whole area, and a lot of farmers who look at that and think about it and simply rely on what I've done there and tell them. No mercy.
Okay. Well, this committee has nothing against mercy bills, right? We're willing to take it into, I believe this would go into our omnibus bill, Representative Shumpert. So, the motion before us is that House File 1047 be incorporated into our omnibus, laid over for incorporation into our omnibus bill. Any discussion on that? If not, then it is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. I have another bill up another committee, so I'm going to go ahead and get this out of the way. Come back.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File. It would need to be referred to the Energy and.
Okay, we'll take that motion. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Okay. This bill deals with actually providing a very appropriate funding mechanism for child neglect. And as we've heard in previous bills this year, and I have to say for more years than I'd like to remember, back years, we have a problem with childhood lead poisoning. We've never really been able to put the kind of funding into it that would move us totally towards removing and preventing childhood lead poisoning. And back today with a bill that actually was recommended in 1991. I have the report. This was a report of the Task Force on Lead Abatement Costs back in 1991. It's prepared by the Minnesota State Planning Agency. It was a vision that was suggested as a result of a whole group of people dealing with both the children who are lead poisoned, the various state agencies that have to deal with childhood lead poisoning, everything from the health department to those landlords that we heard about who needed help with helping clean up the lead poisoning in their own properties, and homeowners who were faced with very serious costs of dealing with the lead in their homes. At that time, it was recommended, there were two options recommended most seriously for funding the cleanup of the lead that's causing childhood lead poisoning. And one of them was to put a fee on paint, which is the one historic source of childhood lead poisoning, the paint that was the lead that was put into paint back in the 20s and 30s, and the lead that was put in at the same time in gasoline. And this bill before us deals with the lead that was put into gasoline. These two areas are both historic sources of the kinds of poisoning that we're seeing of our children today. And I might just recall for you, and you can go back and read, there's a lot of documents, how the public health agencies in the 20s and 30s, when these issues were being discussed, really begged the Congress not to let lead into our environment through leaded gasoline and through leaded paint. They didn't win. In Europe, lead at the same time was in these products were being considered, and it was banned. But this country went forward, and so now we have what the public health agencies said at the time was a real danger. We have toxic lead in our environment, and the main people who are experiencing the result of that and have for the last couple generations are little children. So what this bill does is basically say that the one source that they recommended and that I think is still a very valid source is to have one of the polluters, the petroleum industry, take some responsibility as the polluters having the polluters pay, which is a well-established doctrine in our state law and in our federal law. And so this bill does what I think is very reasonable. It says that an existing funding mechanism, no new funding mechanism, but the existing one, the Petroleum Tank Release Fund, which has been designated for cleaning up leaking petroleum tanks, also add to its appropriate uses, the cleanup of lead and by providing grants then for lead screening and lead cleanup in our communities. And one of the reasons I bring this to you at this time is that this is one of the only ways I think we really can pay for the kind of costs that are incurred by our families and our communities, both local and state and federal government, who deal with childhood lead poisoning. And I might remind you just a couple of the costs. We know that children who are lead poisoned suffer neurological damage. Their brains are damaged permanently for their lives. These are children who end up in our special education classes. They end up with other kinds of disabilities, and sometimes they are, and we have documentation of this, unfortunately, over the years, some of them get in trouble with the law and they end up in our prisons. Just to give you an example of the cost of special education, my understanding from recent documentation is it costs about $3,000 a year for a student, K-12, to be in special education. So $36,000 for our 12 years of school. Because this child was poisoned by one of two sources of lead in their environment. And the issue with the petroleum is that this went on for many, many years. I can tell you, any of you who live near a very busy highway or street or road, it's important that you know, if there are little children there, what may be deposited in that soil. And the organization who was here, the Sustainable Resources Center, one of the things they do in addition to checking inside the house for lead paint dust is to check the soil around the house. Especially if it's a busy street, you're probably going to find lead near the house where the exhaust from the gasoline has been deposited. And it was a totally preventable type of poisoning at one time. But now we're living with it, and we will for... Lead doesn't deteriorate and go away. It's a heavy metal. It stays in the ground. And there's things that we can do to help prevent childhood lead poisoning, but it does cost money. We need, as was discussed, we need children to be assessed and the housing to be evaluated in terms of how it can be protected. Sometimes we need to cover the ground with material that will prevent it from being tracked in, or children playing in it and absorbing the lead in their clothes, in their body. So the bill is pretty straightforward. This committee will not have the final say on what happens with this. I've never had the petroleum industry say this is a great idea and they would get behind it and want to support it. But I do think it's time that we consider it again. It's been many years since we've had this option before us. And so I'd like to ask for the committee's support to pass this bill. I might tell you that the way the petroleum tank fund works, it's a blink-on, blink-off fee. And as it's blinked on each month, it brings in $2.74 million. So close to $3 million a month. And depending on what we ask to be contributed to the lead cleanup, and in this bill, you know, we do have the bill that is trying to bring a lot more assessment and attention to lead cleanup. We want to lower the blood lead level so that we're not waiting until kids get 15 parts per million in their blood. We want to start taking care of them at 0.5 parts per, at 5 parts per million. In order to do that, again, that costs money. And what this means then is that the Petroleum Tank Release Fund would probably be on for several more months a year. And I personally, I hope that you will agree that that is a very good use of our dollars for our children. And it may be as long as 3 or 4 more months, could be as short as 2 months, depending on what the Energy Committee decides to do with this bill. So I'm trying to bring some funding into this committee, or into the jurisdiction of this committee, I guess I should say, for a bill that we've already passed. And I would like you to consider it, and I'd be glad to try to answer any questions.
Okay, before we go to that, is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak in favor or against this bill?
I think there's a...
Okay.
I misspoke. Apparently, the amount that would be raised is 5.48 per minute per month. Is that right? So it might have to only be on an extra month. Okay.
Good evening, members. Mr. Chair, my name is James Pearson. I'm the director of the Petrofund program at the Department of Commerce. And I wanted to share a couple of concerns with you this evening as you think about the bill. Certainly, it's not our role at the Commerce Department to talk about the policy of that. That's not our area of expertise. That is certainly in the domain of your committee and the experts there. Our role is administering the Petrofund program. That's a program that's been at the Department of Commerce since the late 80s. And a program that we're proud of. It's done an admirable job here in Minnesota in its mission on helping people finance the cleanup of petroleum tank leaks. And that's obviously critical as well as far as how we go about protecting groundwater and our state's resources. So we're proud of that. The one concern that we always have, of course, is that is our mission. And as things come up over time, that may expand that. I know Commissioner Wilson always has some concerns about that and whether that's getting sort of beyond our mission. The second concern, and one maybe that is more worth your consideration, is in 2005, the Federal Energy Act passed in Washington, and President Bush signed that in August of 2005. And that bill is a very, very long bill and had about a number of underground tank provisions in it. And as part of that, there is language that talks about diversions from state funds. I have the privilege of being the co-chair of the state fund organization across the country, myself and a gentleman from Vermont, and we're involved in some of the provisions. And one of the things that we're worried about is that diversion piece. Because the way it's written now, if funds are taken from a state assurance fund for another purpose, they may not provide grant money to the Pollution Control Agency. Currently, the Pollution Control Agency, in my discussions with them, it's a little bit over $1 million, about $1.3 million in funding. That is tied to about 15 positions there at the Pollution Control Agency, which is obviously part of the tank cleanup program. And if that funding were to go away, that would be a serious blow to our work in that. So there's a lot of discussion. I can't sit here today and say that if it happens, this will happen. That's not my message. But my message is that it is a complicating piece of information, and we would like the opportunity to talk as we move forward about how this might be resolved and some other options that might be out on the table.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to come on up, please?
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond for a moment to Mr. Christian's comments.
Representative Clark.
This just came to my attention just shortly before the committee, that this was a complicating factor. And I guess I would just say to the committee that I'm interested in following up on this and trying to understand a little bit more about what the actual options are. I know right now we already do have diversions from the specific criteria that apparently are there in the law. I talked a little bit with Mr. Pearson about that. So, as you mentioned, it's something that needs some more consideration, and it's the kind of thing that I would hope we would take. I know it would be taken up in the Energy Committee, so to do with that.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our members are retailers, jobbers. We are, in fact, the fee payers. When we pick up a load of gasoline, diesel fuel, heating oil, at a refinery or terminal rack, we accrue the liability, we pay the fee. I do not represent the refiners. When the Petrofund was originally put in place, it was put in place for two very specific purposes. 1988, when federal and state government required that tanks be replaced through the whole spectrum of tank ownership, this would work to clean up expeditiously the contamination from several years, hundreds of years of underground tanks. It also was put in place to meet the federal and state requirements that there be a financial assurance mechanism. Any tank owner, well, most tank owners are required to have $1 million of financial assurance. And that can be met in one of several ways: insurance, letter of credit, self-insurance, or a state fund. All states went to the state fund because that insurance was not even available in the marketplace at that time. It is somewhat available now, but it is expensive. It has a large deductible, and it is subject to the foibles of the underwriters. So our concern is that if the fund were to be decertified, we would be looking, every tank owner would be looking for insurance. School districts, cities, townships, station owners, anyone who's covered by the fund. This fund has been very successful over the last 18 or 19 years that it's been here. It's a model in the country. It's not been broke. It's not had to have an infusion of cash. It has had the focus of providing those two benefits and has been very successful. And a diversion, I hesitate to call it a diversion because of the reason, but any diversion of the funding that may lead to decertification would be very tough to backfill for tank owners. Thank you. I'll try to answer any questions.
Mr. Krogman, any questions from the committee? Representative Severson, to this
point.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. Sir, could you... I'm trying to get a grasp on the switch on, switch off. So this is just at the distribution level, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, yes it is. The fund is set up that when it is below $4 million of unencumbered funds, in other words, when somebody's doing a cleanup or whatever the cause for use of those funds, the unencumbered balance drops below $4 million. The fund is kicked on, if you want, for 4 months. And the money's raised, whatever the money's raised, go into the fund and then are used until you get to that $4 million level again. And it is assessed against the licensed distributors. Pick a town where you have a small oil company, a small cooperative. Those are the licensed distributors. State law requires that petroleum products have to be received in this state by a licensed distributor. That is where the taxes and fees attach. So the local cooperative in St. Cloud, when it pulls the gasoline over the rack, over the loading rack, at the truck loading rack, the 20 cents state tax applies and the fee applies, and that cooperative pays it, as an example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your testimony, you're saying that a diversion of purpose from this fund would actually impact the viability or the insurability of the particular program? Or
I'm saying potentially, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I'm saying potentially. Like Mr. Pearson, I don't want to say this is going to happen. I'm saying potentially. If the EPA, federal EPA, were to certify that this fund is no longer meets the financial assurance mechanism that is required by federal and state law, then tank owners would have to go elsewhere to find their $1 million of coverage. Would they? I don't know. But the Federal Energy Act that was passed, which kind of grandfathers in previous diversions, says we can decertify.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, what? How do other states fund their tank issues?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, there are a variety of mechanisms. I don't know what most other states do. I think 40-some do have state funds. Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, I know for sure have state funds. In the past year or two, the Iowa moved to more of a insurance mechanism, but the underlying funding source for that insurance mechanism was those monies in the state fund when they moved it. So states all around the country, many of them have state funds.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Representative Eastland?
Mr. Chair, a comment, and then if the testifier wants to comment on it. But over the course of years that I've been in the legislature, we've really struggled with this issue of funding things and creating dedicated funding sources that can provide some security and stability to some of those ongoing funding issues that aren't fun and sexy to fund all the time. And we have one here that's working pretty good. And I mean, I understand Representative Clark's interest in being able to fund the lead cleanup stuff, because that's an important issue too. But it seems like we're kind of doing the thing that we kind of criticize ourselves for doing here by just kind of piling on to something that's working, and to try to create to generate a source of revenue that can kind of do our initiative. So I guess I'm just having a little bit of trouble trying to understand how we can justify kind of going to a fund that was kind of created for a very specific purpose and it's been working well for that purpose, and then broadening the use to something that you can make a vague connection, but it has some distinct differences in its original intent. So that's just kind of a comment, I guess, and maybe I don't know if the author wants to respond to that or the testifier, but it seems like we're kind of stretching this fund beyond where it was originally intended to go. And it seems like we maybe should think about this issue of lead, and if it's important, we should figure out a way to fund it and set it as a priority and go to the general fund. That's the revenue that's kind of there for that purpose and do it. But.
Thank you, Representative Eastland. Representative Clark.
Yeah. Well, let me just come back to say... the one thing that does concern me a little bit is understanding if the 2005 Federal Energy Act has a problem with our using the funds. That's something I just found out again before the committee meeting. And as we go to the Energy Policy and Finance Committee, I sure would want to find out more about that. But I would have to say that unless my commitment would be, I think I've heard from two people now that they don't know for sure what the result is. But I sure would say to the committee that I don't want us to pass up a very important source that is the historical cause of our childhood lead poisoning. If this was something that was not known when lead was added to gasoline, if this was something that was not under, was somehow under the radar, maybe we'd have a little different discussion. If we can go back and there are, congressional and records to look at. This was known. It was known that lead is a human poison, and that adding it to something like gasoline was going to put it out in our environment. And there has never been, in this state anyway, any accountability of the petroleum industry for that. So I think it's reasonable. Not only is it reasonable for us to explore this, but I think the next committee is going to help us figure out. But unless we do this, I don't think we will have the kind of funding available, unless, you want to get our governor to make a commitment specifically to this kind of children. And I think, he might understand this and care about it if it was possible. I don't know if I'm going to talk to him about this resource, but right now we don't have in this committee the kind of resources we need. We don't have in this legislature the kind of resources we need. And so we have families whose housing is jeopardized and whose children's health is definitely impacted. So, it's the very little ones that are affected by, again, historical poison that was put into our environment consciously. And the polluters have not paid in this instance. I think in the state of California, this did pass at one point, and I think they had a fund for a period of time, and then I think the petroleum industry successful in getting them to move it. In fact, that was the case, because that's how the task force that met in 1990 and made the recommendation to the 1991 legislature. This is something you can find up in our library upstairs. It's called the Lead Abatement Revenue and Program Options Report of the 1990 Task Force on Lead Abatement Costs. This is what they cited. So I guess I would just ask committee members to help me pass this potential source on to the next committee, and we can decide there. That's the committee that would be able to tell us whether or not we are jeopardizing any existing other uses for this fund.
Okay, is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak in favor of this bill? In favor of the bill. Thank you. and I'm going to try to limit it here, but you got a minute and a half, 2 minutes at the most.
Mr. Chair, Sue Watlow Phillips, Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing, Minnesota Coalition, and with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I've had the privilege of working with Representative Clark since she first came into office here, and she has continued to push this bill and funding in this committee to receive dollars for lead cleanup. Half of the people that are homeless in this state are age 21 and below. Hundreds of families and children are experiencing lead poisoning and are becoming homeless. I strongly encourage you to pass this bill forward. Let's look at the 2005 federal law a little closer and see if we can't use this fund or an expansion of this fund to deal with the polluters that have created this problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Having heard testimony on this, and I'm actually kind of curious myself on the fiscal note with this, and I'm understanding at this time we do not have a fiscal note with regard to this bill. Representative Clark.
I have a fiscal note for the whole lead that we came today for the lead that we passed in the committee. And it's a little bit confusing. I haven't had a chance to look at it, Emily. But I know that the expenses for OA, for example, $1.6 million, and 09 is $1.4 million, so about $3 million at that
state level.
And then I understand that our cities and local users would also have some additional costs. I don't know if we have anybody here to talk about that, but I heard from my little city that there would be additional county. So this would be a source for your counties as well to help deal with some of the costs that they incur in dealing with children who are vaccinated. And we're talking about probably $7 more million they would. So,
okay. Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I was in another committee. The motion on the table is lay this over for inclusion or to pass?
Representative Moll, the motion is to pass this out of committee and put it on to environmental...
Finance and policy.
Oh, energy finance, excuse me.
Energy finance. Representative Clark, there's some questions about the financial implications of this. Would the author be willing to change that motion to lay this on the table so we could answer those questions before we... pass this bill out of that committee. This committee.
Mr. Chairman,
Clark.
What financial questions? If you missed the discussion, we're talking about the fact some stuff at the federal level, a 2005 change in the energy law. Is that what you're referring to?
Just the potential implications for the petrol fund, which does other important environmental cleanup that many of us support.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Representative Moore, that's exactly why we want it to go to the Energy Committee, because that is what they deal with, and they will be able to tell us whether or not it does have implications. I don't think this committee has the expertise to do that. That committee does. They deal with that. And I'm very interested in what they have to say, because this is new information to me. So I would prefer, Representative Moore, that we take it to that committee and then see what we do, where we go from there.
Representative Moore.
Can I
answer
my question? As
the chair of this committee, I am going to make that motion that we lay this on the table until we find more information about this, and then we can take it up again another time. So I will make that motion, and I understand that is, I believe...
Non-debatable.
I understand that. Yeah. So I'm going to make that motion. That we lay this on the table and we get some more information and we pick it up again once we have that information. So that is a non-debatable motion, and I think that is where we're at. So we'll lay this on the table for this time.
Well, it's a vote.
We have to vote on that.
Yeah. You need to vote.
Thanks. I was trying to move things along.
Okay. Still democracy.
So all those in favor of laying this on the table then, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
No.
Division?
Okay. Hearing division, do you want to read the roll?
No, just raise your hands.
Raise your hands. Okay, sorry. Division is called. Those of you who would like to lay this on the table and voted aye, please raise your hand. Those opposed, raise your hand. Okay, 8-3, the motion carries. It is laid on the table.
Do my committee members. Is Dabney here, Representative Dabney? Okay. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Representative Dabney.
We'll see if my testifiers have figured out to come in yet or not. Good evening, Madam Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to present this bill to the committee. I also have another, I've got a series of handouts for the committee. House File 1744 members would increase state HECAP funding $2 million over the base in an attempt to respond to the rising tide of foreclosures that we're seeing across the state. Between 2005 and 2006, my own county, Hennepin, saw an 81% increase in foreclosures. Ramsey County, a 125% increase. Scott, a 122% increase. But don't think that this is a metro area problem alone. St. Louis County, a 62% increase in that same time period. Stearns County, the same. And Blue Earth, 56% increase. These foreclosures are emotionally devastating to the families involved, but also disruptive to the communities. The HECAP program is a competitive grant program funded through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency that provides homeowner education and counseling as well as foreclosure prevention to families and communities across the state. We have a significant investment by the public sector and by individuals in our communities. In the last month alone, the stock market has taken two steep drops, both based in part on concerns over the effect of subprime lending and the rising tide of foreclosures on the stability of the economy. If we don't act quickly to provide homeowners with the counseling and foreclosure assistance that they need to avoid the calamity that's coming for many, we will lose millions in public and private investments in our communities. The increase that I'm requesting in HECAP funding is but a small amount compared to the possible loss in front of us. I have with me tonight several testifiers, and later, Madam Chair, if I may, I will have an amendment, but I would like to speak and have the testifiers speak to the bill first. My first testifier is Mr. Darrell Dahlheimer from Lutheran Social Service.
Madam Chair, committee members.
Welcome to the committee, and will you introduce yourself, please, for the record?
Thank you. I'm Daryl Dahlheimer, Program Manager at Lutheran Social Service Financial Counseling. I would like to talk a little bit about HECAP from the ground level, that is, those who are providing the actual services, so you have an idea of how this money is being used and the need that's out there. Lutheran Social Service, that I'm Program Manager for, serves 7,000 families a year in Minnesota with financial counseling, a large chunk of which is housing counseling, including foreclosure prevention. And I think we have a unique perspective because we serve the whole state with the financial counseling, and we serve 60 counties specifically in Minnesota on the map where everything is not a colored box. So we serve 60 counties of FRAP funding, but in addition to that, with housing counseling and financial counseling, we serve the entire state. We have 8 offices statewide, and so I'm here really to speak from the perspective of outstate Minnesota as well as the metro area, because this really is a statewide and, frankly, national problem. I also want to mention that our housing counselor, our financial counselors are all certified as housing counselors as well, so it's integrated into our work. Briefly, many people better than myself could tell you about the variety of services that the Homeownership Education, Counseling, and Training Fund provides, but I want to highlight something about HECAT, which is that in the late 1990s, early 2000s, the big focus was really on entering the homeowner market. In other words, in getting Minnesotans to have more opportunities to purchase homes. We've been so successful with that, offering that, that we consistently clock in as state number 2 or state number 3 in the nation out of 50 for home ownership rates. That part is great, and we should feel proud of that. However, the economy and the market has changed dramatically, and now the focus has shifted where HECAP funding really needs to focus on the larger economic trends, rising interest rates, the stagnant real estate valuations that are happening, and, of course, the boom in subprime lending, which all mean that the crying need now is for foreclosure prevention. In other words, the flagship service of HECAT has changed, I believe, from being home ownership, getting people into houses, to now including a major part about helping them keep houses. And that's the crying need for the increase in this funding, I believe. There's still a lot of humans and Minnesotans who would like to purchase houses. That need is universal as a part of the success of the American dream. What's different is now there are record numbers of people facing the chance to lose their American dream through no fault of their own in many cases. An example of that, just to give you an idea of the flavor, in the 7-county metro area, from the years 2000 to 2003, each year there were 2,000 sheriff sales, approximately close on, whether it's 1,800 or 2,100. You're closing on 3 or 4 years in a row of 2,000 average sheriff sales in the 7-county area. Last year, it was 7,000, so more than a tripling of the foreclosure rate. That's typical of what's happening in our state. What that means for Minnesota, as Representative Dabney mentioned, was not only is it a rising tide of foreclosures for individual homeowners, but has ripple effects, meaning that many of these folks are facing homelessness and personal bankruptcy in that process. There's a stagnating effect on real estate prices, and now not only are homes taking longer to sell, but the prices are being stagnant, and of course that ripples through the financial markets as well as creates a drag on our social service system because many of these folks are going to need additional services now that they're going homeless in the absence of proper housing counseling. Foreclosure prevention counseling is not reaching everyone who it could reach. It's been the increase in funding has not even begun to catch up with the number of record sheriff sales happening. Just to give you an idea of the structure of the HECAT funds, there's 2 pots of money within HECAT that pertain to foreclosure prevention I'm here to speak about. The first is a loan pool, a very innovative loan pool, where homeowners who are behind and have a delinquent mortgage can be given, as part of the counseling, a no-interest loan, which they then do pay back to the state pot of money. So it's a temporary loan to catch up the delinquency. It's a really innovative program. I think we may be the only state in the nation that has it. Great. But that's only one piece of it. The second is the administrative pool of money under HECAT for foreclosure prevention. And that allows us to reach a vast number more people because many people don't qualify for the loan. They got behind through mistakes on their part, or they can't no longer afford their house. But it's still important to get them foreclosure prevention counseling for a soft landing. I'd like to just tell you 2 1-minute stories, and I hope it will give a flavor to what's happening in Minnesota. 2 uses of foreclosure prevention funding through HECAP. The first is a story that of someone who was my client in housing counseling in the suburbs in the Twin Cities area, where delinquency on their mortgage was from a temporary loss of income. Quite simply, the family had 2 parents who worked full-time, And the wife in this case was diagnosed with a rather severe cancer and had multiple surgeries, had to take leave at reduced or no pay in one case. And when they came to us, they were 4 months behind on their mortgage. They could no longer afford the mortgage without that, with the devastating loss of income of someone being out. However, with that 4 months behind, we had the ability to help them. We had a foreclosure prevention loan as part of the counseling, which paid for one of the 4 months of delinquency. So we gave them a loan for approximately $2,000. In addition to that, we did expert coaching of how to work with their mortgage company to do what's called a partial claim, which is where 2 months of the delinquency were put onto the end of the loan. So instead of a 30-year mortgage, they had a 30-year plus two. In other words, they're paying everything back in the delinquency, but the point is we're leveraging those funds to be able to get them to keep them at home. And the last month of the 4 month delinquency was simply our expert budget coaching and helping them chop, chop, chop to be really able to bring a month's worth to the table. So with that kind of leveraging, this was something where the loan plus the counseling plus some expert advice and frankly the family's motivation meant that someone who would have lost their year home of over 10 years due to cancer and a loss of income that anyone could face simply was allowed to keep their home. The second kind of example I'd like to give you is someone who did not succeed in keeping their home, but where I think foreclosure prevention funding is essential for the counseling. I'll tell you why. It's a myth that we can help everyone who's in trouble right now to keep their home, but it's not a myth that we can keep them from going homeless, and that's the distinction. The foreclosure prevention counseling can help them have a soft landing versus an absolutely bankrupting event. This is an example that happened this year, where our family came to us victimized by predatory lending outstate, and this family had money in their house in terms of equity that they wanted to tap out. And there were many, many ads out there in the world that say, we will get your money out for you, no problem. And a rather predatory set of terms was offered to them to help their family in Louisiana. They have two elderly parents who were part of the Katrina flooding in fairly desperate straits. They needed to tap the equity out, and they did with a refinance. The refinance, because it was subprime, had no concern for whether or not it was affordable or not. It was simply profitable. And so they were into a loan that they could no longer keep up with. In fact, 2 months into this refinance, they're already a month and a half behind. They come to us, and after two counseling sessions, realize that they have simply talked themselves and financed themselves out of an affordable home. A temporary loan won't do it. They don't have the credit for a refinance, to better terms. They simply are going to lose the house. But with foreclosure prevention counseling, they can know to sell the house, capture the equity, and be able to land on their feet. Other families, they aren't able even to sell the house, but they go through the redemption period and are able to regroup. In other words, there are options out there for people that they don't know about. And there's many, many rescue scams in the foreclosure market that take money from people that were desperate. Housing counseling prevents that. Finally, I'd like to offer you a statistic, please. The pot of money we received at Lutheran Social Service just serves as one example of many, many good providers in this program. But to give you a flavor for it, we received last year at $100,000 of administrative pool and $160,000 in the loan pool. And if you take families that are received, the loans go up to $5,000 max. The average one is $3,000 or $4,000. So if you take the $160,000, which sounds like a lot, that loan pool at $4,000 translates into 40 families. Okay, so we were able to use the loan pool to leverage 40 families. But the administrative pool of $100,000 served 1,400 families. That's the kind of leveraging that can happen to help people learn about their mortgage, to be able to refinance or use the other options. And that clocks in at about $70 a family. If you do the simple math of 1,400 served into $100,000 administrative pool, $70 a family is about what it costs to do this kind of work for someone. It's been that way in 2006, 2005, 2004, 2003. Here's the deal, though. We're expecting foreclosures to continue to rise at a double or tripling rate. So if our demand doubles, as we expect in this state, would you think it's reasonable for us, at a $70 cost, to be asked to do foreclosure prevention counseling for $30? No business runs that way. So we're asking you to meet the demand that's happening, really frankly, as what HUD, conservative folks at HUD even say, is a tsunami of foreclosures looming our way. Thank you. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Questions from committee members? Questions?
Madam Chair, my second testifier is Ms. Cheryl Peterson from Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself, please, for the record.
Yeah.
My name is Cheryl Peterson. I work at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, and I have been a mortgage foreclosure prevention counselor there since 2001. I've actually done intake. I actually also do all the loan closings and also all the funding work with our mortgage foreclosure prevention program. So I do know the HECAT funds and foreclosure prevention counseling extremely well because of that. The first thing that I'd like to talk about, I guess, is more what we do for day-to-day activities. So our program, we really emphasize our foreclosure prevention counseling services rather than just the loan dollars. Only about 10% of our clients actually receive financial assistance. So it's a very small number that actually gets financial assistance. If somebody calls our program, we actually will send out an application. Once we receive their application, we'll go through the mortgage foreclosure process with them, and then we also refer them to a financial counselor. So we look at their budget, see if the home is affordable, and if it is affordable, we'll do negotiations with the mortgage company, and then if we're not able to actually negotiate anything with the mortgage company, then we'll look at our financial assistance. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about our success rate. From 2006, about 62% of clients who applied to our program actually were able to stay in their homes. And actually, in 2006, we also were able to leverage $193,410 through the use of homeowner funds, negotiations with lenders, and then also local county dollars to actually get people current on their mortgages. So really, once again, I want to emphasize administrative dollars of the HECAT funds, I think, are extremely important. I'm also a board member of the Minnesota Mortgage Foreclosure Prevention Association, and so I do actually deal with counselors statewide and have heard accounts from many counselors about the increase in services and the increase in clients, but they're not actually able to serve all of their clients because they don't have enough funding to actually handle that. Another thing that I'd like to talk about is from 2005 to 2006, there was actually 167% increase in foreclosures in Minnesota, and there's actually a decrease in HECAT funds. So from 2005 to 2006, the HECAT pool went from $2.2 million to $1.9 million, and that meant less money for most of the foreclosure prevention programs throughout Minnesota. Our program, we actually did get a slight increase in funds, but we actually got a decrease in administrative funds. So our increase was actually in foreclosure prevention financial assistance. I know that there's a great need, once again, statewide. HECAT not only funds foreclosure prevention, but also funds pre-purchase counseling, post-purchase, and also reverse mortgage counseling. One of the other reasons why the increase in funds is so important is because if a homeowner has actually gone through pre-purchase counseling, they're actually less likely to default on their loan and actually less likely then to call us for our foreclosure prevention assistance. So, and I as well, if anybody has any questions, I can...
Anybody in the audience like to testify to this bill? Any questions from members?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney?
I do have an amendment.
Representative Dabney, let's take up one small piece. We do need somebody to move this bill.
That'd be a plus.
Representative Benson, would you like to move this bill for possible inclusion to our omnibus bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Now we are up to date. Now, how about the amendment?
Mr. Chair, would Representative Benson be willing to also move the AO70424 amendment?
I'm sure he would.
I think I will.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Dabney,
all right.
Amendment, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Earlier, committee members received a map of Hennepin County showing foreclosures in 2006 by city. The challenge before us is this. We know, as Mr. Dahlheimer indicated, that the folks at HUD are talking about the upcoming tsunami in foreclosures. We need the HECAT funding, but we also recognize a need to administer that funding in as efficient and targeted a way as possible. Currently, that way doesn't exist. But
there are pieces that can be brought together with the assistance of this amendment and funds from the state to make that possible and develop a statewide model. Currently, the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County are working together, particularly on homelessness prevention, but also both units of government have a rising focus on foreclosure prevention. The city of Minneapolis, with Kira from the University of Minnesota, has developed an early warning system that looks not at foreclosure prevention, but at people who are likely, parcels, homes, that are likely to fall through the social safety net. An early warning system with an attempt to target resources to those individuals early before they fall out and end up homeless and the homes become boarded and vacant. The proposal from Hennepin County is to take that early warning system, recognize that there are elements that will work on early detection of foreclosure foreclosure prevention, but also recognize that there's not a 100% overlap. The 0424 amendment then appropriates $50,000 to Kira to work on amending, morphing that existing early warning system to try to develop, using publicly available data, a system that allows us to target people at high risk for foreclosure and get them assistance early when it's cheaper for the public, more effective for the families, and then report back to the legislature on the effectiveness of this and make it available statewide for counties around the state to be able to do the same sort of work that Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis are looking to develop. I do have individuals in the room who'd be willing to testify further to this if the chair wishes.
Are there any questions from members to this amendment? Representative Madore.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, what is the date that we're expecting to have that report back to us? I don't see that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Madore, let me start over. December 31st, 2007.
So this would be Mr. Chair.
Representative Madore.
So this will be information then that we may be able to implement some program improvements maybe even next year with that information coming back to us.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Madore. The proposal here is that Kira begin working on this in June and hopefully begin applying it in Hennepin County as rapidly as possible because of the urgency of the situation. Then report to the legislature at the end of this year and exactly what you're talking about. We can then move it out if it's a successful model statewide and look at hopefully supplemental funding or looking at existing structures, existing programs in light of what they're able to do here and its success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess, Representative Dabney, I just had a simple question that maybe you answered and maybe I'll ask you to answer it again. Representing Anoka County, why wouldn't we want to do this in Anoka County? Is that just the concentration in Hennepin County that you're looking at, Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, we have to start somewhere. And right now we've got two units of government that have agreed to work together to develop this, and that's the city of Minneapolis, who already has put, my understanding, literally millions of dollars into this early warning system and are willing to pick that up and hand it over to Hennepin County to then come in with just $50,000 more to work that system so that it shifts its target slightly from folks likely to fall through the safety net to folks at high risk of foreclosure. Then, if we can work that model and get success, be glad to give it to Anoka County. But we've got to start somewhere.
Thank you. Any other questions to this amendment, folks? Okay, then Representative Benson, I'm sure, renews his
I renew my motion.
Add this amendment, and all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carries. So that is a part of our bill now, 1744. Any other discussion from either the audience or members to the bill? Okay, then this bill is laid over into for possible inclusion into our omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time tonight.
Okay, then the next up we have is House File 1837, Representative Madore.
Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Medora, to your bill.
Thank you very much. I'd like to move that House File 1837 be moved for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
And I do have an amendment that's being passed out to members right now.
All the members have received the amendment. Okay. Representative Medora is going to move her amendment to make sure it's in the right shape that she'd like it to be in.
It is, yes.
Any discussion? Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It passes. Now we are dealing with one solid bill. Representative Medora, to your bill.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Today we're here to talk about a bill that allows for a steering committee to commit it to continue its work to develop housing alternatives for people that are currently living in nursing homes. We've established a committee that will consist of some new members, all in the with the goal being that we will develop some new alternatives to nursing home placement for people under the age of 65. I do have one testifier, so I'll just let her pick up here and address some of these issues of bill.
Okay.
Good evening. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability.
Welcome to our committee.
I am here today to discuss House File 1837. It's a bill that relates to the Disability Council Options 2 Disability Service Interagency Workgroup Appropriation. Kind of a long mouthful there. In a nutshell, what Options 2 TOO Interagency Workgroup is, in 2005 the legislature mandated that the Minnesota Council on Disability, Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency work together to work on an initiative to basically create this work group to prepare recommendations on how to help people in Minnesota with disabilities that are under the age of 65 to relocate out of nursing homes into the community. Again, that's always a mouthful, but you have to say that all because people get worried that I'm trying to get grandma out of the nursing home. And grandma, wants to leave, certainly we will do that as well, but this initiative is for folks under the age of 65. So it's good to note that anyway. So we convened this in 2005, and basically in 2006, the work group worked together to come up with the initiatives. And the name Options 2 came from the initiative that started in 2001 by the Department of Human Services, if you're wondering where the name came from. So basically, this group was led by a steering committee with broad representation across the disability community, advocates, providers, county social workers, and public housing, and other stakeholders, and so forth. So what happened, basically, with this charge, the committee basically came up with several recommendations after this year-long effort. And just to kind of give you an idea of what they were, the good news is Minnesota is doing some work on this initiative. The numbers are reducing that are the folks that are actually stuck in the nursing home. It fluctuates between 1,500 and 2,000 within a given year. Two, current programs of funding need to be maintained, though, if we're going to keep looking at the reduction and not increasing. And gaps in the current system must be filled because there's still some huge major gaps. And we just need to continue to assess whether the system is working. Currently, when you're looking at what exists out there, there's no one point of contact for your folks if you're stuck in a nursing home to call up your county or anyone to say, hey, I want to get out. It's a process of 5 to 6 referrals within the county, and then if you're lucky, you might get someone who might know something and how to start the initiative. Data information is horrible. The good news is there's information. The bad news is it's everywhere, and there's no one place to get it and to get it to the people with disabilities who are stuck in the nursing homes. Housing, again, no means of tracking of what accessible units exist out there for those that need accessible housing. Transportation, 7 out of 87 counties still have no accessible means of transportation. So what good is it going to do if you get somebody out of the nursing home and you get in the community and you can't get anywhere? Quality assurance, that's huge as well, and ongoing monitoring and gaps analysis. There's no systematic statewide effort here for the continuation of the services and availability here. Just continuing to move forward here. So what this bill would do is basically look at coordinated options to implementation efforts that were conducted here and created this last year in 2006. And what the committee's recommendation would be here is to there would be a full-time implementation coordinator, continuation of the steering committee membership, and also the development of the communications plan to educate the consumers, stakeholders, and to basically work on getting the information out there. The list is long here of what needs to get done, as well as the list of people that are stuck here in their nursing homes. And we can't forget about the folks coming back from Iraq, the veterans. They're going to be another group of population that are going to be at risk here to be stuck in the nursing homes as well. So, as I said, the list is endless here, it seems like. So, as you can see, what will happen if the House File 1837 is passed here, it'll allocate necessary funding so that ongoing statewide implementation and coordination will continue with the steering committee's work plan on relocation. You'll see here that the list of people that will be participating on the steering committee, with the addition of the Department of Human Services, MHFA, our agency, the Council on Disability, Veterans Affairs has been added, along with the Transportation Department and the continued other stakeholders throughout the state, in particular the Centers for Independent Living. So the funding basically is going to pave the way to help get these 2,000-some folks out of the nursing homes and back into the community. And there will be an annual report that you folks will be able to see as well. So basically, this effort under the House File 1837 will help us prevent nursing home placement for all people with disabilities and basically work on the services and support that they need so they can continue to live meaningful lives. So we urge you on behalf of the disability community to support this initiative and bill.
With that, we stand for questions.
Sorry, Representative Medora, we're trying to organize some stuff here. Okay, is there anybody that would like to speak to this bill, either in favor or against, in the audience here? Seeing none, any questions from members?
None.
Made a good case, Representative Medora.
I guess we did.
Then the motion does stand to lay this over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill, and we will take that action.
Thank you very much, members and Mr. Chair.
Representative Hundley, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move 298 to be recommended to pass.
Oh, that's great.
I'm going to have a couple of what you're going to need to do, what we're going to need to do. Except I've lost it already. Yes, some of these matters have financial to be in the omnibus bill, and some are policy, and we would like to have those go separately, a separate bill. So some of the finances in this bill are in my committee, and some are in Representative Park's committee.
Okay.
And it's already been heard in my committee, so I can simply take those sections that would have apply to my finance committee, and that would be sections 2. So what I'm going to do is move to delete section 2 from this bill.
Okay.
And then section 4. Six and seven. Well, I may have the wrong sheet here.
Reimbursement rates and the appropriation.
I got it. Here's the right one. So I've removed the delete section 2. And I'll get a vote on that.
Yeah, I think we are. I think we should. Can we put them all together?
Well, the trouble is that Section 4 relates to Representative Parks, your committee.
Oh, okay.
And Section 6 relates to the appropriation for also Representative Parks' committee. And
7 as well.
5 is money in my committee, so I would. I'll take care of my committee first. I move to remove Sections 2 and 5.
Okay. Motion is to delete sections 2 and 5 from the bill.
And then we have the two sections that relate to funding in this committee. And we probably ought to. Ultimately, they're going to go out and be laid on the table for possible inclusion. Bill.
Our bill. Yeah. So we should probably leave them there then.
Okay. And, Chair, I have another bill right up there.
Okay.
Upstairs.
But I think.
You want me to discuss the bill briefly and then turn it over to the testifiers?
Yeah. Why don't we, if that's right with you, I know you're the author here, but if we can get testimony possibly while you're gone, I'm assuming you probably already know that testimony very well. That way we can ask questions of those, and then maybe you can put your cape back on and fly back down here and take care of this stuff.
Well, we will see.
So, but let me get just maybe parliamentary question for members. I mean, we just removed Section 2 and 5 from this bill. Is that something that we need to vote on?
Yes.
Okay, I would assume that that would be the case. So those in favor of removing those two sections to get it in the shape the author wants it in, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Okay. To your
what's
bill.
What's left in the bill, Mr. Chair and members, is Section 1, which allows nurses to dispense contraceptives at family planning clinics. Currently, drugs can only be dispensed by either a physician, advanced practice nurse, or a pharmacist. This would the nurses in these clinics work directly with a advanced practice nurse, and this would allow them to basically dispense contraceptives when the nurse was not there, or the advanced practice nurse was not there. I have a letter from the pharmacist. They're support this. They're not opposed to allowing somebody else to dispense, which normally they're concerned about, but in this case they're not. It's only for contraceptive drugs. Section 3 is an amendment that just allows the nonprofit community clinics to form joint powers agreements with other units of government. And Section 4, currently in law, there is a reduction in family planning grants that's scheduled to start next year. That was in the belief that a federal waiver would supply lots of money in medical assistance to do the same kinds of services. It turns out that waiver is not working nearly as well and has not been implemented. So what this does, in fact, the governor in his bill wants to delay the implementation of this cutback. So what this Section 4 does is permanently delete the reduction in family planning grants. Section 5 is gone, and Section 6 appropriates $8 million for the biennium to the Commissioner of Health for Family Planning Grants under Section 4, and that's it. In addition to the roughly $7.5 million that are in the current budget.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Morgan.
I'm having a problem here tracking what the author was. Particularly in those last couple of sections he mentioned, I've got a House research summary on the second engrossment, and it looks like we have the first engrossment. And I'm wondering if we should be working off the second engrossment.
What I have is the one for the second engrossment that was delivered in my office today.
Okay. I don't have that bill, Mr. Chair, the second engrossment.
Can we get staff to fix this problem?
Six.
Yeah. I think, Representative Huntley, we have. I think your intent was to remove Section 6, but this might be the old. This might be the first one.
Great.
So, yeah, do we have the right document? We're still working on that. We're just making copies. Okay, copies are being made. If we can get copies, can we hear testimony and then come back to this?
I'm fine with that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morgan.
Turn it over to the testifiers.
Wonderful. Yes, I know you're wanted up there, as am I.
Representative Huntley, I just have a question. Sure. I don't think we clarified where the bill actually is going. You said a couple sections. You want somewhere, possibly a couple of sections.
The policy should go through the chair of the
Representative Huntley.
Overall finance.
I think
New York.
No, just the
to finance.
Carlson. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just procedurally,
Representative Huntley,
he might know better, but don't we have to move this bill one place? Can we actually say part of the bill is going to go somewhere else? I don't think we procedurally can do that. Don't we have to move the bill and then Chair Clark can take some parts of this out and put them in an omnibus bill? I believe. If it's been heard here.
I think what she's going to have to do is take sections 4 and 6 and lay them on the table for possible inclusion in the bill and let the rest of the bill go.
Okay, so we can make have a motion to lay those two sections on after testimony and then what's left over. So you're going to refer the, here your motion would be to refer the bill to finance?
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative McNamara. Representative Clark, you're back.
I'm back.
Welcome back to your committee.
Temporarily, at least.
Yeah, I actually have to excuse myself to the same place he's going.
Members of the audience, we have a number of committees meeting and a number of bills up, so please excuse us. That's why all this time is going. It's not that we're not interested in the topics before us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Brian Russ. I'm the executive director of the Annex Teen Clinic in Robbinsdale. I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak to you tonight on behalf of this bill. The Annex Teen Clinic has been providing confidential sexuality-related health care, education, and counseling services for teens and young adults for over 35 years. I would like to talk with you today about the cost effectiveness of the Family Planning Special Projects Program and the impact the Minnesota Family Planning Program, i.e. the waiver, has had on our clinic. My message to you today will be that unless there's a significant increase in funding for family planning special projects, as well as a significant increase in the reimbursement rates for the Minnesota Family Planning Program, you can expect to see a diminished family planning infrastructure in Minnesota, resulting in increased unintended pregnancies, increased abortions, and increased MPIF expenditures. The Annex Teen Clinic has been providing family planning services for teens and young adults in Northwest Hennepin County, including North Minneapolis, for over 35 years. Our model has been extremely cost-effective due to the fact that we reutilize over 100 volunteer physicians, nurses, educators, and receptionists to extend the capabilities of 11 paid staff. This model has allowed us to see an average of 1,900 patients each year. We've never turned a patient away due to an inability to pay. Until last year, with the implementation of the Minnesota Family Planning Program, we had not processed insurance claims due to confidentiality reasons. Our sources of support have included Family Planning Special Projects funding, contracts with Hennepin County, and United Way funding. All of these sources required competitive funding proposals and significant accountability measures, but were able to be administered very efficiently. For fiscal year 2005, our auditors calculated our administrative costs at 7%. Last year, with legislation cutting FPSP by 50%, we felt we had no choice but to prepare for the Minnesota Family Planning Program. This required that we purchase new billing software, computer hardware. It also required that we shift staff away from health education and volunteer recruitment and coordination, as well as hire new staff for the front desk. Now, instead of staff educating patients about health issues, they're educating patients about the Minnesota Family Planning Program. Now, instead of staff recruiting and training volunteers, they're helping patients complete the Minnesota Family Planning Program application form and following up on additional information requested by DHS. The bottom line is that the Minnesota Family Planning Program has added approximately $50,000 in additional administrative costs to the annex's budget, doubling our administrative expenses. Our experience during the first 6 months of the program is that the reimbursements are not covering our costs. Shifting resources from direct medical care and education to administrative expenses is not sound public policy by anybody's definition. The goal of the Minnesota Family Planning Program is expressed quite clearly by DHS: to decrease the number of unintended pregnancies in Minnesota. I'm sure there are many benefits to the program that I fail to recognize. However, for many of us family planning providers, the program is not financially sustainable, and it is difficult for me to see how we will accomplish the goal of decreasing the number of unintended pregnancies if the capacity of family planning providers is diminished. If you truly want to decrease unintended pregnancies, it is imperative that you significantly increase funding for family planning special projects. It is the most cost-effective strategy for strengthening the family planning infrastructure. I'm also not ready to throw in the towel on the Minnesota Family Planning Program. We have spent down our reserves making substantial investments to participate in the program, but an increase in the reimbursement rate is essential for the program to succeed. It seems to me the overriding question before you today is, are you serious about preventing unintended pregnancies and the associated emotional and financial costs, or not? If you're serious about this issue, it will require additional investments in these programs. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak with you about these issues. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee members.
Senator McNamara.
Chair Clark, I apologize. I'm like totally confused, and I don't know if it's the time of day or what, but I'm glad you're back, Representative Huntley. Maybe this is what Representative Morgan asked about, but I don't find consistency between two of my documents. Representative Huntley, I just want to ask again, are you working off of the bill or the summary when you talked about your sections?
I was working off the summary of the second engrossment of
Representative Huntley, I'm told that the second engrossment is not available to this committee yet, and so that's probably where the confusion is coming from.
One of the changes.
Maybe if you could point out the difference between the first and second engrossment.
Section 5 of the bill that you have in front of you was no longer there.
Okay.
We removed Section 5, and so the following two sections that I referred to used to be.
Six is now five, and seven is now six.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, did you remove Section 2
correct
of the bill, House File 298?
My first amendment, what I removed, if you have the first one, I removed the section that says reimbursement for family planning services. That's section 2 of the original bill. And I left in section 3 of the original bill. And section 4 of the original bill is in this committee of finance division. I have not moved that yet. And then, as I said, Section 5 of the original bill is history.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, can you read the heading to the section
you're deleting, just because I have one. That's, this is where I'm confused.
Okay. You want to know the two that I removed in my mind?
No, I got, excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I got the section two. But section five on the bill I have is called Family Planning 1115 Medicaid Waiver. Right. And then section six is Family Planning Reimbursement Rates. And are either of those out now?
Section five of the bill that you have there was removed before it got to this house.
That's what, Madam Chair, that's what Representative Eastland's been trying to explain to me for 15 minutes. Representative Huntley, it must be your PhD that made it work.
Let's hear from our staff here, Ms. LeFevre.
Madam Chairman, perhaps it would make it more understandable if instead of saying the section number that's deleted, we say page 3, lines 25 through 28 are deleted.
That was already deleted before it got here.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, he's deleting these for purposes of his amendment. The section of 20 to 24 has already been deleted. On the first engrossment, Representative Huntley is moving to delete page 3, lines 25 to 28.
Representative Huntley is moving to... this is on the table right now, this motion?
No.
You already did it. Okay. So section 6 is out.
Section 6 has been deleted.
My understanding is...
I'm sure I can tell you, I think I know how to do this now. what my amendment today did was remove lines 118 and 1.2. And lines 3.25 to 3.28.
These were already
in. Line 3.2 to 3.24 were already gone.
Representative Huntley moves that lines 3.25 to 3.28 on the first engrossment be removed. Any discussion of that amendment? Everybody understand it's the section entitled Family Planning Reimbursement Rates? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
We have to also do the
1.18 again, the 1.22. Does that have to remove the removal of 1.18 on page 1 to 1.22 entitled Reimbursement for Family Planning Services? Any discussion on that amendment? If not, Representative Shumper.
Representative Huntley, Madam Chair, could Representative Huntley tell us why you...
Madam Chair and Representative Jumper, those two sections will end up in my omnibus bill. And you now have left two appropriation sections in the bill that are appropriate for this committee omnibus bill.
Thank you. Okay, the amendment is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and that motion is deleted. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, committee members.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Laura France. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist in solo private practice here in the Twin Cities. I'm here today as a board member of Midwest Health Center for Women. Midwest Health Center for Women is an independent, nonprofit clinic that provides a full range of reproductive health services to over 3,000 women each year. Currently, 57% of the women we serve through our family planning services are women of color, while 90% of our patients are low-income women. Looking at these statistics, you can tell that Midwest serves as one of the safety net providers of family planning services in Minnesota. I'm here as a voice for these women and for the women we are no longer able to serve. With the budget cuts in 2003, Midwest Health Center for Women was eliminated from the Family Planning Service Project grants program with a loss of $90,000 per year. It's been 4 years now since we received FPSB grant money. Because of the cuts and the subsequent loss of funding to Midwest, we've had to turn away over 500 women per year. We no longer have the resources to serve these women with low-cost exams, sexually transmitted infection testing and treatment or birth control methods. In addition, we no longer have the resources to reach out into the communities and to help these young women where the vast, most number of unintended pregnancies are occurring. You may be aware of the recent statistic from legislative research that 55% of the recipients on MFIP started because of a teen pregnancy. And in Minnesota, there's a hugely disproportionate number of teen pregnancies in the African American and in Latina communities. When Midwest received the grant funding, we were able to do much needed outreach to these communities and to help these young women. During Midwest last year of FPSC funding, we provided outreach efforts to nearly 6,000 people, both women and men. Finally, I'm here to urge you to increase the Family Planning Special Projects grants to meet the need that is out there in our communities. This is an investment in the women of Minnesota. We all know that it will save money in the long run. I encourage you to all to please find the resources so that clinics like Midwest Health Center for Women can once again help the women that need family planning services the most. Thank you for your time and any questions.
Thank you, Dr. France. Any questions from committee members? Well, thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Connie Lewis, the Vice President of Planned Parenthood, Vice President of External Affairs for Planned Parenthood. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to support House File 298. In Minnesota, Planned Parenthood operates 24 health centers and provides high-quality, affordable reproductive health care to 55,000 people. Our overriding mission is to help our patients prevent unintended pregnancies and to provide testing and treatment for sexually transmitted infections. In Minnesota, more than 260,000 women need publicly supported contraceptive services. And the state's publicly funded family planning clinics only serve 40% of those women. More than half of Minnesota's MFIP spending goes to families that began with a teenage mother. Studies show that a poor woman's 4 times more likely to have an unintended pregnancy, as is her higher income counterpart. And in addition, sexually transmitted infections have reached their highest level in the state. The Centers for Disease Control identified family planning as one of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. And Minnesota has long recognized that public investment in family planning is good for our state. However, federal and state funding of family planning has not kept up with the cost of providing services. The primary source of state-subsidized family planning services in Minnesota has been Family Planning Special Projects Grants, the FPSP grants. Nonetheless, despite the significant cost savings to Minnesota for adequately investing in family planning, funding for FPSP has gone down since its high point under the Carlson administration of approximately $5 million annually to its current allocation of $3.8 million annually. It's very important to the public health of Minnesotans that funding for this state grant be increased. And the recently implemented Medicaid Family Planning Waiver expands family planning services to more low-income patients, those with incomes up to 200% of poverty. But the federal government enacted this waiver program as a means to supplement, not replace, existing state family planning programs like the FPSP program. We strongly support the provision in the bill that would allow a registered nurse to dispense oral contraceptives under a doctor's orders. Current law, which stipulates only an advanced nurse practitioner may dispense oral contraceptives, is an expensive and unnecessary limitation on registered nurses working in family planning clinics and greatly affects our ability to serve particularly patients in greater Minnesota. In conclusion, it's by putting prevention first that we take a significant step toward ensuring the health and well-being of Minnesota women and families through the promise of accessible family planning. Thank you for allowing me to come and address you on this important subject.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Any comments or questions from committee members? Not? Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for giving me a chance to speak today. My name is Michelle Van Branken, and I'm a family practice physician, although I work predominantly in three different family planning clinics in the metro area in Robbinsdale, Excelsior, Minnesota, and in the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis, focusing on reproductive health care, which at those clinics means birth control services and STD services as well. And I'm also asking you to support further appropriations beyond the Medicaid waiver that's currently in place for family planning special project grants for the clinics. I am grateful for the Medicaid waiver. I think it does act as a source of revenue that does target certain groups of women in the state of Minnesota, but there are a handful of ways where I feel like it's lacking and definitely impacts different populations within our state in different ways. From a public health standpoint, if I were to step back, you know, my training is in family practice, and as part of my training, when I first came out of residency, I first worked in a traditional clinic, and I can tell you that reimbursement is not there in our traditional fee-for-service model for spending time to truly educate around how to use birth control methods, to truly look at what gets young women into clinics to get the services when they need them, to look at why certain populations come in, to look at why different methods might be used incorrectly or correctly. You usually have about 10 minutes, and there's not necessarily nursing there to provide some of that education or backup. It's not a fault of the clinic. It's the fee-for-service model, and the traditional family practice clinics are not necessarily there as a public health institution. They're there to do primary care services in a totally different format. The family planning clinics, on the other hand, we really truly do have a public health mission, our goal, which I think, you know, despite some of the controversy around some of this, we all hope that there are less unintended pregnancies for women in general in our state, and that's our main goal. And in these clinics, we take the time to really look at those barriers. So one of the ways where the waiver does not help us out is the time that our nurses take to educate our clients. That includes clients that come from other clinics that were given birth control and don't know what to do. It doesn't include the outreach that goes out into the community. It doesn't always necessarily cover all of the STD testing. In addition, the other main piece that it doesn't help us with are those folks who are not getting the waiver, are not falling into the waiver program. And that may be because they just barely don't qualify for that waiver program, which usually means about $10 an hour as a job that they have. It's not that uncommon for our young folks in this state. And it also includes folks who see the waiver process as a barrier. We may see it as an easy form to fill out. We may disagree about that, but if they're not filling it out and it's not happening, then it's just not happening. And part of our public health goals are to try and figure out what those barriers are and to try and make sure these folks are still getting covered for family planning services as well. So saying all that, I hope that you'll consider some additional funds and alternative sources of funding to the family planning special project so that we can really look at this problem of unintended pregnancy from a public health standpoint and really try and target it from multiple fronts. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Doctor, could you pronounce your last name again?
Sure. Van Branken.
Van Branken?
Van Branken.
Van Branken.
Yeah.
Okay. Doctor, if you can tell me what you think, if we're able, and this, I guess, is also a question for Representative Huntley, I think this more than doubles what's in the governor's recommendation. Can you, Doctor, tell us what some of the things that will be able to happen now and how the money might be used? Is it just going to expand the programs we have, or will there be different uses for the money compared to what has been happening recently?
Well, I think it probably... I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative. You go to medical school, but still don't know Robert's rules.
Not Robert's rules. It's actually just the legislative way of keeping things historically on tape so that later when people are listening, they'll know who's answering the questions.
I think it gives us the opportunity for both. Already we have some infrastructure with these family planning clinics to continue to provide services, provide outreach. And so there is a piece of that piece to not lose that because we're not able to supplement that through the waiver process. But I also think there's also opportunity to really look at especially things like disparities within our state. I think we had another speaker mention that rates of unintended pregnancy really hit different populations within our states in different ways. This is true for a variety of medical problems from a public health standpoint. And it's where I feel like we're really at the tipping point for really trying to sort through the complexity of why these disparities happen, which is partly related to access, but clearly not only related to access. So I think it leaves opportunity to really try and explore and tackle some of these issues. I don't know that I have the answers for all those yet, but we keep trying.
Madam
Chair, Representative Huntley, so this would One, I guess, first is a question. Does this, was the governor's recommendation about $7.5 million, and this would be an additional aid on top of that?
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, this, the governor's recommendation was, I believe, roughly $7.5 million, and this would add $8 million to that. This, if that's what the finance committee, so that is a very large increase. But I will say that up till about, and somebody can give me the exact date when it was cut, but it used to be $10 million, and it got reduced down to $7.5 million.
Mr. McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And either Representative Huntley or Doctor, will you change the scope of the things that this money is used for? I know you've moved some of the language into a different bill. So I'm curious, are we just, would this just expand the current use, it would be the same uses, but expand it to some of these populations that the doctor mentioned that are in need of this, and we might be able to help them?
Let me, there's an application process by these community family planning clinics to get money, and last year there was not enough money to fund roughly 25%, is it? Roughly 25% did not, even though their applications were fine, they just put not enough money to fund them. So some increase would go to these clinics that did not get the funding.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Huntley, so I never heard you say you don't intend to expand the services offered with this money. It's to expand the similar services that we currently have for more opportunities, not to change how the money would be used.
That my intent is that that all the clinics that are approved by the health department would get funded. Raise the amount. They would provide basically the same services that they have provided in the past when they were funded.
Any further questions? No, thank you very much, Doctor. Are there any other witnesses or who people wish to testify either for or against the bill in the audience?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Huntley, I'm trying to get the numbers to jive here. So essentially the governor's budget is 7.5. It was 10. And we're adding 8 on here. And is that 8 under the base, or is that one-time dollars?
It's 8 on, well, the, that's an interesting question. I think it depends, Madam Chair and Representative Severs, what you mean by base, because these grants are we fund them for the biennium, and then we have to redo it every year. And the governor did have some in his budget. The 7.5 is in his budget.
Madam Chair.
Representative Severs.
And Representative Huntley. So then would this be 7.5 plus 8 for 15, or about 7.5 per year as a base ongoing? Is that what I'm understanding here?
The 8 is for the biennium, so it's a 2-year period.
And Madam Chair, what is that noise?
Go back on to your...
Go back on here. I need it. Madam Chair and Representative Huntley, so then the 7.5 would be split. Okay, so the total funding for the biennium would be 7.5 plus the 8, which would be 15, or 15.5, or about 7.75 per year. And the previous funding was $10 million on the biennium, or about 5 per year. Is that correct?
The high point was 10, and it's been 7.6 since 2005?
For the biennium.
For the biennium.
Okay. And Mr.
Representative Severson.
Mr. Chair. And Representative Huntley. And that's a... It's a significant boost, and I guess some of the concerns I've had and heard about in the past have been, you know, some of the aggressive measures that family planning has used to go out to the schools and hand out condoms and those type of things. And those are some of the issues that I think were what kind of drew some of the funding back in the past, that were aggressively going after children, not children, but young adults or kids at the high school age that are actually promoting and instead of doing the things that we are trying to encourage, and that's some of the programs that have been instituted since, and I think Enable is one of those programs. And unfortunately, we don't have $1 million in that program this year, and that's coming out of TANF, and it's coming out of TAC under this committee. But my hopes would be that we could generate a comprehensive, of which that whole abstinence process would be part of that, and I'm wondering if maybe some of your, some of the people within the Planned Parenthood are amenable to that. I'd have an easier time supporting this whole thing if I knew that that whole process of Enable was part of this process or integrated in. And Mr. Huntley, if you want to speak to that at all.
Representative Huntley?
Well, Chair and Representative Severson, those are separate funding items, and they're not in my bill. What this committee wants to do with that, like that. I'm not sure. Is Enable in the health department or is it in the...
Mr. Chair.
Because there's some in education as well.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you, Representative Huntley.
Any other questions? Kind of shifted around here. I think, are we at the point right now, Representative Clark, to... Are we laying it?
Do you want to move the two financial sections to be laid on the table for possible inclusion in your bill? So that would be then I would move numbers. I didn't fight with you again. Sections 4 and 6, which would be...
Let's let Ms. LeFevre indicate which numbers are so we get it straight here.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, I think it would be lines 2.17 through lines 3.19 and lines 3.29 through lines 3.32.
Could you repeat that, please?
Lines. This is to lay these sections on the table for possible inclusion in this committee's omnibus.
And the section. To lay them over.
Yeah. And those sections would be lines 2.17 to line 3.19 and line 3.29. to line 3.32.
Does committee members understand the motion?
Madam Chair, so what happened to section 1? He described it before. Is that not in the bill?
What, Madam Chair and Representative, what's left then is the section that allows nurses at family planning clinics to dispense contraceptives under direction of somebody licensed to do that. And that's still in the bill. And then section 3, which is the section that simply allows them to nonprofit community health clinics form joint ventures with governmental units to enter joint powers agreements. This is a way for them to get bulk purchasing power for the drugs that they buy.
Representative Huntley, your sense of that, that's not the part you want to stay in this committee.
or is
no, those two, the dispensing are still in the bill and would go from here to the finance.
All right. So, members, do you understand the motion before us? It was the language that represent that Ms. LeFevre read. That's the motion to lay over, to be removed from this bill, first of all, by our vote, and then after that we'll move to lay it over. So, the motion is to remove those portions from House File 298. Any further discussion? Representative Eastland.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I've never been observed this process occurred and occurring in the legislature since I've been here in 6 years, that we take a bill and we dismantle it in a committee, and the bill has always just moved through, and if some things we wanted to include, we just passed the bill out of here, and then we chose to include some of those things because we heard it. Maybe staff could help. Is this the procedure that we're supposed to be using? I don't know that I've ever heard it. I mean, Huntley, you've been here a lot longer than I have, but I've never seen this, quite frankly, and I guess I'm questioning whether or not this is what we're supposed to do.
We're dealing with two problems, Madam Chair, Representative. The one is that there's financial components of this bill that belong to two finance divisions. Okay, so that's the problem. The problem, and I think we've taken care of those two things. Actually, a finance division can put anything in or on this bill that they heard, even though the bill might not be in their possession anymore.
Well, that's kind of the way that it seems like it has always worked before, that the bill would pass out of here, and we'd be aware of the pieces that needed to be in our finance bill, and they could just go in our finance bill. We wouldn't have to dismantle the bill to do that.
Let me just comment to you. This is making everything very transparent to the public. I think it's confusing to them, like what's hanging out there somewhere that we might include in our bill. And I think the effort here by Representative Huntley is to be very clear about what we're putting in this bill, and not only for us who are around this table, but also for the public. So I think if it hasn't been done before, it might be a model for making sure that we have very open processes. Mr. Huntley?
Madam Chair and Representative Eastland, the other reason for doing this is to be honest, that the two policy pieces are important to me and to the supporters of this bill. We can send those out separately and not have to be blunt, to worry about the governor's vetoing the finance bill, still protect the policy part. So that's what my intent here is to protect the policy part, keep that in a separate bill, apart from the finance bill, so that can work. The governor still might veto it, but at least it won't be for the financial reasons.
Madam Chair, I guess you're the chair. You can do what you want here. It just seems like this is a process that I guess I've never seen occur before, and it's just a little. I don't believe that transparency is always what it appears to be. I mean, so clearly there was other reasons why he wanted to do this that were more political than transparent. I still raise the question, is this an appropriate way to move the bill forward?
Representative Eastland, what Representative Huntley is talking about is different. He's talking about the part that's leaving. The part that I'm referring to being transparent is the part that's staying. And, frankly, we can go with whatever Representative Huntley wants, but I think we were trying to let the audience know or the public know what's still alive in this committee or what will be put into this committee if this committee chooses. Representative Huntley.
And Madam Chair and Representative Eastland, maybe this is unusual, but I'm sure it's legal and the Senate should have done exactly the same thing.
Okay. Any further discussion? Everybody understand this motion?
Yes.
What we're doing? Okay. All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion prevails. Motion adopted. Now we have before us, if I understand correctly, we have maybe two motions. One is to lay over the portion of the bill that was just removed. And
committee members, that's what we'll do. We'll lay it over unless there's any discussion. All right. And then Representative Huntley, your bill, the rest of it, you want us to pass it out to the policy committee. Is that correct?
To the finance.
Finance committee. I mean, to the finance committee. Yes. To the big finance committee in the sky. Representative 298, we pass to the finance committee on its way eventually to your finance committee.
No, just to the floor, probably.
To the floor? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was in and out enough. I didn't catch that. Okay.
And Chair?
Representative Matthews?
Just before we vote, I was going to ask our counsel if I could confirm which lines of the bill are still left in the bill. Just whenever we get whenever we're done and ready.
Representative McNamara, do you mean the bill that is leading this committee or the bill that is being laid over for possible inclusion? What is your desire? Which committee?
No, ma'am, I'm okay with, Madam Chair, I'm okay with what we laid over. I understood
okay.
that. But I just wanted to confirm what was left in the bill, so we're going to send to finance.
Okay. Do you want to know that right now? Because we're going to vote.
Whenever you're going to, just before you vote, I didn't know if there was other questions.
Any further questions, committee members? If not, maybe we'll ask Mr. Faber to clarify that again. Bill that House File 298, what's left of it that's going to the big finance committee?
Madam Chair, members, I believe it's line 1.1 through line 2.16.
Madam Chair, lines 1.18 through 1.22 are also gone.
Good thing we're clarifying that.
So it would be 1.1 to 1.17 and 1.23 to 2.16.
Does anybody have that?
Yep.
Motion is before us and House File 298 recommended be referred to the Finance Committee. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails and House File 298 is on its way to Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. I guess I thought we did. We did that.
No, we did.
There's some minutes before us that the staff would sure appreciate if we could approve.
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes from Wednesday, March 14th.
This needs to be a little bit quiet until we're done. Representative Morgan moves the minutes from the discussion. If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes and the minutes are approved. Any further business to come to this committee? Not. We adjourn.